time for more movie thoughts. Also, little known fact, Richard Fitzwilliams now prefers to be called Richie.
So will it be a case of he wins by default because Phil Lynas, despite suggesting going for a Zoom challenge for the predictor, the annual Oscar prediction challenge, Phil has not turned up. He may burst into play, but then again, we'll just have to wait and see. Having said that, I may be speaking too soon, because although Richard Fitzwilliams is there and is ready to actually take the whole process by default, we can say that from a bunker somewhere in the world of Bidensville, we do actually have Phil Lynas ready and connected with us, saying, hallelujah, he has a connection. How are you, Phil Lynas?
I'm good. I'm actually coming at you from the editorial suite where I work. And so it's always a little bit nerve-wracking that I'm going to get a good signal and that I'm coming through loud and clear.
You certainly are. I had faith, you see. I knew you'd let us know if you weren't, because Alex would have begun 10 minutes ago. He's so hasty, you know.
Look, I would like to, if I may, my New Year's resolution was to never do a Zoom ever again. And I did break that New Year's resolution on January 26th when I had to host a meeting of the Charitable Foundation, of which I'm president. So it was for a good cause. But had I not broken my New Year's resolution for that, I certainly would have for this. And because the universe has a sense of humor and a delicious sense of irony, my newest corporate client is Zoom.
Yeah, exactly. So you're the one who'll take all the flak. We also welcome our studio audience today, and indeed capable soul, Jessica Burtis from North Carolina. How are you, Jessica?
I'm doing pretty well. How is everybody?
I think we're fine. I mean, it's currently America 2, UK 2 in terms of numbers, but we're not interested in those numbers thing. It's the Academy Awards program, which, as I say, currently, if we look over the past year, we didn't have one last year, partly because of the pandemic, partly because Phil was allergic to Zoom. But we effectively went back. The last previous 2 years, Phil Lynas actually winning just over the last couple of years. So it's Phil Lynas 2, Richard Fitzwilliams 0.
And yet, Alex, it's not about winning. Just to be nominated, Richard and I are both winners.
Absolutely. It's the thought that counts. You're quite right. You're quite right, especially when you've got such an impressive collection of films, as I believe they nominated in this year's Oscars, and better, in my view, than the BAFTAs. And I want to hear what you think.
Well, I don't know what the BAFTAs were, the nominations were, so I can't speak to that. Isn't that terrible?
That's fine, Phil. Honestly, time will work on that. Apart from saying, and we'll hand over to yourself, Phil, initially, and then Richard can pick up on this one. Apart from saying that, I do have a sneaky feeling that just as you actually put your package together to say Richard Fitzwilliams now prefers to be known as Richie, marvellous, I also can say that there is a secret love that Richard actually has for the House of Gucci. And I know, despite the fact that he kind of regularly sort of lambasts the accents and the style of Jared Leto and Lady Gaga in House of Gucci, I know he secretly wants it to win. I don't think tragically it will. I think it'll be something completely different. I don't think it'll be June either, but I know he's a House of Gucci fan. Anyway, Phil, over to you.
Well, I don't know a lot. But I do know that House of Gucci won't win the Oscar since it's not nominated.
Alex was pulling your leg, you see.
Oh, I see.
The whole thing, that was his idea of a joke. Totally misleading.
It's a good joke, Alex. It's unusual but unexpected, because usually jokes have a humorous climax. But speaking of, I guess Richard didn't like House of Gucci. I haven't seen it. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, I mean, don't bother. But the interesting aspect of House of Gucci is only one thing, and we can discard it, and that is Lady Gaga got nominated, in fact, at the Globes and at the BAFTAs for a performance. All right, but it wasn't too bad. But the whole movie was a load of nonsense. It was, the makeup was terrible, the music was execrable, and as far as the accents were concerned, I mean, it's just become a lie. It's a joke. Ridley Scott must be in his anecdotage.
Well, when we think of great screen comedy, we think of Ridley Scott, don't we? No, we don't. Of course not. You know, there have been very funny performances in films that he has directed before, but he's not a comedy director. I would also say, though, that based on Don't Look Up, neither is Adam McKay a comedy director anymore. A worse comedy. I almost called it a big screen comedy, but it's on Netflix, so it's somewhere between a television movie and a big screen movie. Poorly reviewed, a film with no, just an angry movie, unlike what I would expect from Adam McKay, who directed the pilot for The Great Succession and even managed empathy for these characters, for the Murdochs of the world. But so filled with anger, that is a ham-fisted attempt at satire, Don't Look Up. And yet, because it fits in with the political agenda of Hollywood, embraced as a Best Picture nominee, the best part of it, Leonardo DiCaprio not getting nominated. So.
No, it's extraordinary. The Jennifer Lawrence DiCaprio performances seem to me to be fine. But one thing you could not say, and that was Don't Look Up, is subtle, because this really, really was heavy-handed. But of course, linked to the Trump era and the fact that you had scenes that were quite amusing. Overall, I have to say, I think I started about three. I was amiably disposed to it, but don't let's pretend that this was an exciting, dramatic movie that was part comic, part tragic, and of course the link to climate change and so on. But I think one of the things that struck me, and I wonder whether it struck you, it was I got 9 out of the 10 for Best Picture, because they did seem obvious, and I'm glad they went to 10. The only thing I would say, quite honestly, Nightmare Alley, I wouldn't have included. I would have included Tick, Tick, Boom, which I thought was much better, more preferable.
Well, so a couple thoughts here. First of all, I love amiably disposed to something. I've written that down, and I will be stealing that phrase from you, if you don't mind. Steal from the best. That's what I was taught. You know, I've been speaking about this a lot lately. I feel that when something expresses the sense of outrage you feel, you support it. That's how we seem to be wired these days. And Don't Look Up seemed to express the outrage of certainly the voting body in Hollywood, which explains why it sort of stands out as kind of the height of mediocrity on this list. Whereas so many of these other films are so blissfully refreshing in their lack of outrage. They truly tell stories of characters, dare I say, trying to do their best. And in terms of Nightmare Alley, which again is an exception to that, here's a lead character that has no best, has no humanity at all. I'm glad for two reasons that it gets a nod. One, because it is a big screen movie. This was a film made for the big screen, best seen on the big screen. And secondly, I had the great pleasure of seeing the film with a discussion afterwards with Guillermo del Toro. And the film worked sometime for me while watching it. But after hearing him speak about it, it is not necessarily a better film, but I find it to be maybe the most interesting movie of the year.
It is interesting that you make that point, because funny enough, one of the things that you said, that the movie, it was uneven, but nonetheless, I halfway through, I was getting irritated. I thought it was garish and over the top, and then suddenly it changed and became somewhat stylish. So the first hour, I felt I was rather swamped by it and by the rather grotesque, over-the-top aspects of it. The second hour, I was drawn into it and intrigued, although Cate Blanchett, I thought, was, again, vamping it up just decibel too far for me. And then the last half hour, I thought again it went into overdrive. So
We're exactly the opposite. I have all the same criticisms you do, but I level them at the opposite parts of the film. In fact, I did rewatch the Tyrone Power original recently. And if I could edit the city sequences from the Tyrone Power film into the Guillermo del Toro circus pieces, then I feel you've got a masterpiece. Combined, they're one perfect film.
Okay, we've had the sort of general preamble, which is good. I'm just cutting across, Richard, here. Jessica, I'd like you to actually be our official note taker here, and it forced you, good self, to make sure that you have the final predictions for both Phil and Richard. And we'll start actually off with...
We're not predicting anything today. I'm looking at the list for the first time.
I agree with Phil. I don't think it's necessary to predict. I think we could, before the Oscars, when that's quite a way to go, let's do it then.
That is historically how we do it, Alex. We send you our predictions, and then you bring us back and hold our feet
yes,
to the fire.
History is
that
hungry.
Is how we traditionally do it.
So let's start off.
You don't want to do the predictions now. And we would rather talk about any snubs that we think. We would rather talk about what's interesting. How about the fact that the wonderful Japanese film Drive My Car nominated for Best Picture? How about the great film from Norway, Worst Person in the World, getting a screenplay nomination? These are extraordinarily wonderful accomplishments. How about the fact that, as Richard was saying, they expanded again to 10 Best Picture nominees and it let in more quality as opposed to what the plan always was, which is we expand to 10 so that blockbusters can be included so that we'll get more eyeballs on the Oscar race.
I'm going to ask you, this is a terribly sensitive and very important, I mean, alas, at the heart of all this is a ceremony where how many people are going to watch it?
Well, and this Richard, is one of I'm the going to again the, cut across this, and I will actually muting you, Richard, if you do not actually sort of acknowledge, I will be muting you. Jessica, as we've obviously changed this format, your role now is to obviously act as a bit of an arbitrator between the two giant folk that we actually have here. And let's first of all ask you, will you be watching the Oscars?
I'll be interested in the results. Sometimes, I don't know why, but I avoid Oscar movies that are, like, nominated. I think maybe, I have, like, the same feelings about the Pulitzer sometimes. I feel like some of the films can be, like, really great and I enjoy them. And then sometimes when I watch them, I just feel like they're hyper aware that they were going to get an Oscar nomination. And maybe I'm just like a heathen or something watching them. I don't know. I feel like I can't appreciate them. But I think like a few years ago, I like watched Parasite after I saw it had like an Oscar nomination. And I was on an airplane when I watched it. And it was like, it was a mistake. I was just emotionally drained for like hours. But no, I'm interested to hear what Richard and Phil have like a consensus on or really disagree on. So I can kind of watch those ones specifically. I'll be interested.
Well, I like that you brought up Parasite because you did say, you know, there are these Oscar bait movies that we've all grown so tired of. And so that's what one of the reasons that it's so exciting when you have a Roma from Mexico nominated for Best Picture or a Parasite from Korea or in this year, Drive My Car from Japan. Because let's face it, these are filmmakers coming from countries where in their right mind, they're not thinking to themselves, oh yeah, this has a shot at a Best Picture nomination.
I quite agree. And the other thing is the It means so much if you win Best Picture, because if you look at Parasite and the vast amount it made, and I just, you mentioned Robert, and I, you know, there was a movie I thought was the nearest thing to a perfect movie, beautifully made, superbly acted. If you look at its gross, it's hardly grossed anything because it fell at the last hurdle to The Green Book, was it not? I mean, it was such a pity.
Well, Richard, it was released onto Netflix. It debuted on Netflix here in America. So its box office fortunes are going to be tilted because of that. We still live at a time where international global box office is driven to a degree by how the film is perceived to have done in America. And in America, it had no theatrical release.
Ah, the tragedy, because that was a beautiful movie. And I also think that one of the changing demographics, you brought up the fact that Drive My Car, marvelous film. I mean, 3 hours, absolute bliss for me. And the structure of it was fascinating, a wonderful screenplay too, and all sorts of nods to the classics. The cast was superb. I was really fascinated. But it's just struck me, one looks at a movie like that, I can't see it doing a Parasite, but I think that one of the reasons that we're now seeing more foreign language films in that last, up to 10 now, of course, it's a changing structure of the Academy with 9,500 or something like that voting members, and it's thought about 20% from an international. So I think that's the reason.
I think changing it's just like an election, isn't it? I mean, it is politics, Richard. And in the political world, we always hear about changing demographics and the changes because of technology. How do those things affect the outcomes of elections? I think you're already seeing it in the Academy over the last few years. It's both the type of films that a changing demographic might be open to, but also the evening of the playing field with technology, where screeners become much more available to everybody digitally. And before that, look at these. Looking at this list of Best Picture nominees, Power of the Dog, released straight to Netflix. King Richard, released straight to HBO Max. Dune, straight to HBO Max. Don't Look Up, straight to Netflix.
The one on that list, the one exception, I don't think they intend that Dune 2, they will not be doing that. In fact, it was actually released, I think, 2 days before online because of a technicality and contract.
But the point was that these films were able to build great momentum in a election campaign sense, because the voting body had already been able to get up in the morning, stay at home, and watch them. So it does change things. I would like to say, though, that I do think a snub, and I'm not saying who of these five aren't deserving as Best Director, but to nominate Dune for Best Picture and not Denis Villeneuve for Best Director is very odd to me, because what a heroic, Herculean effort. As we know, great filmmakers have failed to successfully make Dune in the past. It is not an easy challenge. And for Denis Villeneuve not to get a Best Director nomination.
David Lynch did his best, and he actually did a very good job with the original Dune adaptation. Jessica, I'm not sure where that's actually taken us, but I have a suspicion that generally we might be looking at Power of the Dog as being the likely prediction for both. Dune, because it's science fiction, frankly, doesn't have a chance when it comes to the Academy Awards. The only time they gave a nod in the direction of science fiction was for Black Panther, and that was a box-ticking exercise, but there we are.
Alex, can I just challenge your point? Just in theory, anyway, you're quite right, of course, that rather like 2001 and the fate of all sci-fi movies, the Oscars don't like them. But could we just be perverse for a minute? The thing is, as an admirer of The Power of the Dog, as someone who wants it to win and who believes it's going to win, and everything is sort of pointing to that, in my opinion, at least if I had to bet, you could also say it's a Western. It's set in 1920s Montana. Now, how many Westerns, Cimarron in 1931 and The Unforgiven and Dances with Wolves in the 1990s, but those are the only West or period Westerns that have, in fact, won at the Oscars. So in theory, the odds might perhaps favour Belfast in that respect.
However, let's talk about the odds for a minute. And I think I beat you 1 year. I don't know whether you predicted 1917 or which one it was. Oh. But I know that I had a piece of information, Richard, that you did not have, which helped me get it right. And I'm going to share it with you now, which is I believe Parasite is the first Best Picture winner ever not to be nominated for Best Editing. The correlation between editing and Best Picture had always been in lockstep. Not that they won both, but it had always been nominated for Best Editing, which is why it is surprising that Tick, Tick, Boom is not nominated for Best Picture, because it is nominated for Best Editing. The only Best Picture nominees nominated for Best Editing are Don't Look Up, Dune, King Richard, and The Power of the Dog. So I would argue one of your winners, one of those four, is your winner for Best Picture.
I think The Power of the Dog is going to be the winner. And I think you probably agree with me, but aren't saying so quite yet. I mean, Belfast.
Yeah,
what did you think of Belfast? Because there I thought it was a lovely movie. I thought it was extremely good. But dare I go quite this far? I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was well cast. I thought that I loved the way it was photographed, the use of colour. There's Branagh looking back with a sentimental...
Sadly, he doesn't have a moustache, though, Richard, which is a great pity, because the moustache...
On Sunday, the moustache is awful. The moustache was awful on The Word on the Orient Express, and the moustache is not particularly good in this new movie, Death on the Nile. And I won't... No spoilers on that, Alex, because you could be touching, since you haven't seen it, on something that...
I mean, the moustache is a critical aspect. If you can't have an Academy Award winning director with a raccoon on his upper lip, then frankly, life is not worth living.
But you know, with Belfast, it's a docudrama, and it also has some particularly powerful scenes of rioting. This is one of the biggest surprises, though, for me, and that was, I don't know how often she appears, because I remember Judi Dench winning for Best Supporting Actress for Shakespeare in Love, and I think it was worked out that she appeared for the second shortest time in Academy history, and suddenly she's popped up again. Here's my surprise. I was completely thrown by this Best Supporting Actress nod. Fair enough, I think excellent, but I didn't expect it.
Wow, so much to cover in that. In answer to how I feel about Belfast, I feel like that movie is right up my alley, not my nightmare alley, my actual alley, and I haven't seen it. It's sitting on my desk at home, and I have not watched it yet.
Phil, it's a two-parter. You need to see it as a two-parter, because Branagh actually, Belfast starts in colour and goes to black and white. Death on the Nile starts in black and white and goes to color.
Well, can we talk about Death on the Nile? So I haven't seen Death on the Nile. I mean, I've seen Death on the Nile. It was with Peter Ustinov. Is this Death on the Nile an improvement over that Death on the Nile?
Oh, hugely.
Because the Murder on the Orient Express, do we agree, Alex, that Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express was a huge step down from the original Murder on the Orient Express?
It was, by the way. Just let me have one word here. If you're thinking of Academy Awards and you're thinking Sidney Lumet, you're thinking of a certain Albert Finney and that sort of jerky, ridiculous, it was like a mechanical doll he played.
Richard, you need to declare your interest. You're a personal friend of David Suchet, so inevitably anybody owning Suchet who does Poirot, you're going to take his side. It's okay.
Not Alex. Tony Randall.
I object. I must most strongly object to the idea of favoritism, that it will alter my critique in any way. Alex should be shamed.
I'm just calling out declared interests. That's all. Declaration of interest.
I absolutely deny it. And not only that, I would quote to you Amadeus Oleana, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The Price. All my son.
Wow, Agatha Christie. I did not know Agatha Christie wrote all those. But
Agatha Christie did not do anything of that kind. As you know perfectly well, that is a hilarious joke. The facts are David Suchet acted in them and they were on stage.
All right, so Richard, is Death on the Nile, which I do think the original film can be improved upon, is the Kenneth Branagh version an improvement upon the late 70s version?
It's not an improvement on it, but it's, look, we're in the time of a pandemic. People want a piece of superficial, glossy fun. It's got almost nothing to do with Agatha Christie and this Branagh's own invention of Poirot. I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but he's all right, it's an Olympian ego, and maybe having made Belfast, he deserves a bit of fun. I've never seen so much CGI generated scenery in Egypt. They actually went to Morocco to film it, but they should have also paid attention to something called a script. It's also got Army Hammer in it, which turned out to be a very, very considerable.
It's a tough PR exercise, Richard. Oh, that's all. It's a tough, yeah. It's a challenging PR exercise, but you know,
that's
other than that,
rough.
You know,
that's rough. You need a really big mustache on Poirot to distract from Army Hammer. While I have Richard here, I do, and I shared my little bit of expertise, which is arcane Oscar trivia about the best editing category. I would like to ask Richard to speak about one film in particular, because it is being listed as a huge snub here in town, directly Frances McDormand not getting nominated for her performance as Lady Macbeth. I did not think she deserved to be nominated. I love Frances McDormand, but I didn't see Lady Macbeth in the movie. I'm a half hour into the movie and she's giving the out, out, damn spot speech already. And I'm thinking, we're there already? Boy, all we did was just cut her best speeches. It felt like a highlight reel of Lady Macbeth and not an actual nuanced exploration of character, which I did think they gave us with Macbeth. But I yield to your expertise of Shakespearean drama, Richard, and I'm really curious about your
take on it.
Beware
though, Shakespeare, deadly in terms of a cancel culture. It's borderline in terms of how long Shakespeare survives before he's cancelled.
That's a terrible thing to say, Alex. That really is truly sad, if that has any link to reality. But
Merchant of Venice, clearly anti-Semitic. You can go on from there, effectively.
So Lady Macbeth.
On Macbeth, just dealing with Macbeth, which I saw at the London Film Festival and was fascinated by. The visual style of the movie was what appealed to me, and also the way the witches, I mean, the way in the beginning, the atmosphere, it was almost as though, I mean, I thought Denzel Washington and I thought Frances McDormand were extremely good, but it was the atmosphere of evil that pervaded the whole of the castle, about everywhere, the witches, in fact, completely controlled. Evil controlled them. I thought Frances McDormand was exceptionally good, and I was very surprised when suddenly she appeared nowhere and people didn't share my view, because Macbeth is completely, even in his castle, he's visited by the witches. The witches, whether they appear in a particularly interesting shape and form, and I would give a best supporting nod to the actress. I think it's Catherine Hunter, but I can't remember.
This is, again, I yield to your expertise, but this is my feeling about it. I realize now that you kind of put your finger on it. I felt that the witches, which were extraordinary, which had to be the reason that Joel Cohen wanted to make this in the first place, that they almost usurped center stage from Lady Macbeth.
Oh, totally. In fact, from both main characters. But the one thing the movie did, and every play of Macbeth is doing this now, and I was waiting to see, so this is not really a spoiler, because if you know Macbeth and you've seen Macbeth in recent films and on stage, this happens every single time, and that is when Macbeth is killed, because we all know he dies climactically.
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, Richard's known for giving spoilers and endings away, Phil. Don't worry.
I knew you'd jump at that. That is a complete evil lie. No, what I'm actually going to say was, after Macbeth's death, what happens, and the consistency now is becoming slightly boring. We know, therefore, that there has to be a greater evil in the land, because I've seen it on stage several times, and it's now the case that you will find it, I think, well, I think you agree, climactically, it's successfully conveyed, but it's always interesting, and I think they're going to have to think something else up.
Richard, there is a greater evil in the land. She's called Nicola Sturgeon. End of.
I am certainly no admirer, but I agree that Frances McDormand, in fact, when I saw the film, and I mean, you were less than captivated by the performance. I mean, Lady Macbeth, I saw Judi Dench in 1972 with Ian McKellen, and I mean, it was just absolutely seared me to the brain. I mean, it was an incredible experience to see it. And I've seen a variety of versions of it. And of course, we remember Polanski and Orson Welles.
My favorite, my personal favorite of Macbeth is actually Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood.
I was going to bet. Brilliant.
Okay, moving on. We need to bring in Jessica once again. Jessica, in a world in which clearly we're having the new line that you can now actually identify as being a feline in terms of one's particular gender, this has been brought up by Bristol University recently, one of the Russell Group of universities, who are now actually accepting that you can actually use a pronoun which refers to meow meow, as in a gender alignment. I just want to actually raise the question with yourself. Do you feel as though we should abandon the best actor and best actress categories for the Oscars and simply have best performer? Jessica, what say you?
I'm not somebody who knows a ton about drama or the industry, so like I'm an outsider, like looking in on this.
The best person, Jessica. The ideal neutral, the observer.
To me, I do honestly kind of like the difference in actor and actress, just because I think it's kind of nice. Like, I think seeing how the characters are portrayed differently, I feel like just having, and I feel like having best performer, I feel like maybe I don't know if they would like try and keep it like even as far as gender goes, because I feel like men could like sweep it again, just because like there might be some,
this was always the reason behind the separation, Jessica, was that if there was not if there were not performing categories for women, there would be no women nominated, period. If there weren't multiple acting categories, for many years, there would be no performers of color. There would be artists of color nominated. And also historically, if there were not female performance categories in the Oscars, a lot of female-driven films never would have been made in the first place, because their chance to box office revenue was to get award nominations. So it is, you know, I understand the argument that, well, it's binary, it's just men and women. How does that make sense? What are we going to do moving forward? And the reality is that actors are actors. If we're going to have them competing against each other anyway, we don't have female directors versus male directors, female writers versus male writers. So why is it just performers? But there is that economic reality, which is if you remove it, I fear you're going to see the number of female-driven movies plummet. You're going to see the salaries that female performers make plummet. There's going to be real-world ramifications.
And you're going to see the number of awards, of course, cut in half because...
Which would mean shorter running times, more viewing figures. And if you take the Brit Awards as an example, the Brits have actually adopted that policy and far more women have been nominated for Best Performer than men.
You would not see fewer awards. You would see other awards added, Alex, like Best Stunts, which I've been saying for a century should be a category.
Here's a real problem now, and that is that we've got the ceremony that can go on, we know, to 4 hours, and in fact, you always surpasses three. Now, if you're going to cut the 23 categories, aren't they? If you're going to cut that, I mean, that's one thing. People desperately resent the idea. The BAFTAs, as you know, do it. They won't broadcast it live. They broadcast it later, and they have the categories at the end just as almost a sort of subliminal flash, very, very quick. If you do that at the Oscars, of course, there's ferocious opposition. And if you add stunts on, that's 24 or whatever. I mean, the length of time does seem to bear, unfortunately, a great deal on the number of people are going to watch. Under 10 million this last year, even if it allows for the pandemic, down from 20 million the previous year and so on. And whatever you think of Titanic at 87 million in 1997, I mean, that seems just an impossible dream. You've really got a problem now, whether they're going to have a host, apparently. They haven't for 2 years. I thought it was fine without one. But I mean, the point is, how do you draw audiences back to awards? Globes have sunk without trace, and maybe they'll rise again, but it won't be for quite a while. The BAFTAs have made absolutely clear that they want to go down their own passageway and not be influenced to the Oscars, because 19 out of 24 were first timers. Half the movies chosen were British. That isn't going to be reflected at the Oscars. And they moved in 2001, as you remember, before the Oscars to influence them. That was the idea. So how do we get back to those?
And Phil, I've got to actually say, that's the end of part one. We only have two minutes.
I would say that it. I would say my friend Richard asked the wrong question, and I think everyone's asking the wrong question. I'm not really worried about getting eyeballs on the awards. I'm worried about how do we get people back into movie theaters.
And I think Spider-Man movies.
I think if the Oscars are going to serve a purpose in that regard, they need to completely reformat it to make it better advertising for going to the movies. How about a Masked Singer kind of competition where it's a reality show that's a half hour long every night for multiple weeks, and you do one category a night?
Hosted by Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, and then you lead into the Masked Singer, or you lead into America's Got Talent,
or the mustachioed actor, or performer,
or whatever it is. Because the truth is, no one under our age, Richard, is interested in watching a 4 hour show anyway. At best,
let's just test.
They're going to be watching the highlights on the internet.
I totally agree. I must just make the point. I totally agree with Phil. Of course, we should be asking about how to get people back into the theatres, but we're talking specifically about the awards, and it is a serious point if you're not going to get audiences at all, or practically none.
Well, maybe not on television, but that's what I'm saying is, if you craft it for other media, if you do it in more bite-sized pieces and you craft it for other media, other forms of the Oscar app, whatever it is, maybe you're generating more overall views, more overall impressions, and that's the possibility to get people interested in going.
Remember, the Oscars originally
were not televised. Remember that they took 20 minutes and they were in a hotel ballroom.
1929 is not now. Yes, very true in those days. I know, but.
So having just muted Richard, and I did actually warn him three times, so he has been muted. Jessica, I'm going to turn to your good self and give you the last word. Will you be watching the four-hour Academy Award production?
I'll keep it on in the background. I think my generation has a very short attention span. We're the generation of TikTok and Vine, and that's hard to overcome. But I do have a friend who, like, she watches the whole thing and she makes categories. So, you know, some people are really into it that are my age. I think it's very dependent. So
it's a good point. And maybe we should actually just have the best TikTok performer award as well, which should be good for China, nothing else.
TikTok boom.
Exactly.
You know, and short attention spans, Alex, is why I did not want to make our picks today when we have 8 weeks before the Academy Awards presentation.
So this has been a preview of the predictors with Richard Fitzwilliams and Phil Lernis. Richard, I have unmuted, although it has to be said, Richard Fitzwilliams now has the record for the only person I've ever had to mute physically twice on these programs. It's there. He's a rebel.
Why was I muted at all?
As I like to refer to him, Jacob. So that's by the by. So thanks to Richard Fitzwilliams. Thanks as ever to Phil Lernis. Thank you, Jessica Burtis. We'll be back for a whole range of other bits and pieces. And let's finish off with that classic line, keep watching the movies.
Jessica Burtis flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
So are you still checking out the happening artists and the Brits? Do you know your Stormzy, Fiona or Adele? Is it all down to age? Well, apparently it may well be down to age. And there is a certain cutoff point when actually you should really consider stopping your Justin Bieber listening habits. Is that viable? Is that the case? Well, we're delighted to actually welcome the Chief Executive Officer of U3A, the University of the Third Age, Sam Morgan, with us. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So this particular research reveals some fascinating views and possibly some not so underlying ageism in terms of what people should be listening to or what other people believe you should be listening to, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a survey of just over 2,000 members of the general population, and they felt that... if you're going to listen to Justin Bieber, the cutoff point was 39. Anyone over the age of 53 should avoid going to an Adele concert. And the upper threshold for seeing Stormzy was 44. So,
which is interesting, of course, because when you consider artists like Rod Stewart, of course, and Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger, they obviously would be banned from listening to any of those outfits, absolutely. Really.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure what they'd feel about that.
Well, there is this sense that, of course, rock and roll has traditionally, or music, I should say, rather than rock and roll, has traditionally actually had a notion of being partly about rebellion. You go back to the 1920s, the Flapper generation, the Lions from that, the Bobby Sox fans of Frank Sinatra in the 40s, of course, the revolutionary aspects of the 60s, punk in the 70s, in the 80s, we had, of course, a whole range of sort of things. And anecdotally, certainly talking to students at the University of Lincoln, it does seem as though the last 10 or 15 years were a bit unusual because a lot of folk who were in the late teens, early 20s were listening to material that their parents listened to and not under sufferance. It was actually they were enjoying it. So is this a case of reverse psychology that, you know, whereas obviously it's okay for people under 30, for instance, to listen to anything they want, if you're actually over 50, that's it. You've got to be very careful.
Yeah, it was. We had some interesting results. I mean, certainly we also polled 2,000 of the members of U3A, and they felt unreservedly that they were going to listen to exactly what they wanted to listen to and had a whole range of different tastes. But interestingly, both groups felt that it was that music offered a really great opportunity to talk to other generations about you know, shared experiences in relation to music. So younger people said that they loved exploring their parents and grandparents' music collections, and our U3A members felt that it was a really great way to bond with the younger generation. Music is a great way, a great opportunity to perhaps challenge some of those perceptions about what is acceptable to do or not do as you get older.
You see, I could use the patronising line, you're probably too young to remember the oldest swinger in town, but, you know, that would be sort of dreadful. But it is a case of interesting in terms of the sequence there. You have got a number of interesting experiences. I mean, 1 in 10 actually suggested that they felt patronised for listening to younger artists and indeed felt actually awkward when they might have admitted to even like Oasis, which I thought was most unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had some really interesting stories. So we had one person that said that they were at a concert and a girl said to a friend and herself that she must be related to the band because of their age, you know, not just because they wanted to be there to enjoy it. And, you know, another story when someone was on holiday, music being played around the pool that she was singing along to, and she was told by a stranger that she was too old to know the words. So certainly there are some, you know, some sort of rather, you know, strong views held by some people. But I think the purpose of this piece of research was really to challenge that thinking and ask people to, you know, who may hold those views to think again, because they themselves, we all hope, will get older too. And actually, as you get older, people still love music of all types, love exploring it, love sharing it, love experiencing it. And, you know, it is a big backdrop to the way we live our lives.
I can understand the concern about Bieberphiles and Justin, of course, that maybe there is a concern with that. I mean, you know, you might have had to have an age warning on whatever age you are for listening to Justin Bieber. But surely in terms of Adele, that is something where actually you almost have to have lived some life. So, you know, there's an argument for saying that anybody under 20 who hasn't been through the agony of personal relationships that Adele has been through, given our latest album, All About It, or known as the Divorce Album, actually you wouldn't understand in any case. So actually you do need to have a certain amount of maturity or experiential enhancement to begin to appreciate that.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. Although I think what we are trying to say is that with music, whatever stage you are in life, it's always good to share that, because I expect that, you know, conversely, there may be some experiences that are expressed in Stormzy's music, for example, that actually may not have been experienced by some older adults. So I guess it goes both ways. But what we're trying to say is that it's really important to be able to share a love of music, to explore new music together. And music's often a background to the history of, you know, to what's going on in current events at a time. To be able to explore that together across generations, I think, is a real opportunity to build those bridges. We want to be united in our communities, and to really, you know, enjoy it any age and see its value. And I think this particular piece of research is perhaps challenging those people who may inadvertently from time to time sort of forget that they themselves may get older, hopefully, and be experiencing, still want to experience new forms of music just as they do now.
Composer John Williams just celebrated his 90th birthday. We'd notice some of the other earlier pop artists who would have crossed that age threshold. I mean, this is something where I think people need to possibly just take a step and just to think about where they actually were, because you made an excellent point there, Sam, in terms of, I suppose, the classic line from Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend, Keith Moon, hope I die before I get old. Many people haven't, and obviously have become more chronologically gifted, so why should that actually stop them enjoying good music?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was great that in both the surveys, that opportunity for, you know, that real realization, there's an opportunity of actually sharing enjoyment for music, came through, which is good, because, you know, it is, we use music to celebrate major milestones in our life, whether it's birthdays or weddings, or, you know, just going somewhere to enjoy music together. Music's so important to us that actually being open to people listening to music of all types at any age is really important.
Indeed so, although arguably engaging in dad dancing, which is what I believe our Prime Minister was supposed to be doing with respect to ABBA recently, not a good view, and I prefer to actually step away from that. It's not U2, which of course is the band known for its Irish links and Bono and the Edge, etc., but it's U3A who we're talking about now. And where can people go to find out more details about the poll and indeed U3A?
Great. Well, you can find out more information about U3A at www.u3a.org.uk. And also Google it. You'll find a U3A near you. And if you're in retirement and you want to pursue new interests, make friends, do undertake new activities, have a good time generally, look up the U3A. It's a great organisation.
And who are your favourite musical artists? Are you a grime or grunge or a serious rapper? Or are you a kind of classic folk artist? Are you sort of more concerned with the romantics, the new romantics? Where do you position yourself?
I think my favourite music is probably soul music, but I still like a bit of George Michael, and I'm afraid to throw back to the 1980s. I still love Bananarama.
Well, you know, the Robert De Niro was waiting. Venus
Absolutely.
And Venus, the whole range of things there. And yeah. And who could ever forget Na 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 Na, Kiss Him Goodbye. There we are. Sam Morgan, Chief Executive Officer of U3A. Huge thanks, and keep on rocking, Sam.
Thank you very much. Bye for now.
There's an old saying which went something on the lines of it takes a thief to catch a thief. Maybe it takes a scammer to catch a scammer is one of the key modern 21st century equivalents to that, especially when you actually realise that there is an exponential rise in terms of online fraud. Recent findings suggesting that scammers are in particular targeting online games from Candy Crush to FIFA and indeed World of Warcraft. Nothing seems to be safe. So who could actually rescue us from this dreadful situation? Well, as mentioned, the UK's leading ethical hacker, that's the wonderful Jamie Woodruff. How are you, Jamie?
I'm good, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Now, obviously, you've got lots of experience in terms of hacking. You know all the sort of systems. You even have got into a whole range of social media accounts and so on. So just how easy actually is it and how dangerous is it for people who might naively be signing up for online games, etc., to not realise that they're basically leaving themselves wide open to online fraud?
Yeah, I think it just kind of stems down to the fact that, you know, a new game gets released, we want to play on it, you know, we'll queue outside for the physical copies or the deluxe editions, etc. And then, you know, we just want to jump straight into it. So we don't really think about the, you know, the sign-up process or what details that we're essentially sharing. And once we're playing that game, you know, it only becomes a very short period of time, whether that be 1 day or 2 days, etc., just to think, okay, well, you know, my friend's playing, but I want to get a better advantage, right? And what a lot of people are doing is they're going online to third-party websites and they're signing up to buy digital currency for these particular games. So if we look at World of Warcraft, you buy 1,000 gold for like £6.46, you know, for 1,000 gold directly from the developer. But then when you go on a third-party website, you might be able to get the exact same 1,000 gold for like less than 17, 18 pence. So people then sign up with all their credentials, their email address, all their identifiable information, including their financial information as well, to make the transaction possible. That then gets stored on that third-party website and they get their digital currency or digital goods. But what they don't realize, a lot of these websites are set up as scammed websites, right? So you put all your credentials in. What they do is they see your password that you've used, and 9 times out of 10, again, a lot of people reuse them passwords over and over again, right? So they'll use that password to log into your email account, and then they'll start recovering maybe some financial accounts or different types of games that you're playing on, all because you purchased digital currency, not directly from the developer, but from a third-party website.
Now, it's a stat to find that, according to TalkTalk, 71% of folk surveyed know that someone who's been targeted by scammers when playing a game online. Now, is that just to do with the huge popularity and value of the gaming industry, or is it just a case of people tend to switch off their common sense mode when they go online?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of falls back. I mean, there was some more research as well as part of the study that you just quoted, where 46% of gamers have purchased currency in the actual game, whereas 47% have admitted to handing over financial details to other players when doing so. So we kind of open ourselves up because, you know, it's 50% is obviously the game developers, where you've got to make the legitimate purchases to get your legitimate items. But then there's this dark marketplace that exists where there's digital goods traded all the time. If we look at kind of, for instance, some of the current games like New World, for instance, that's just been out for a couple of months, there's a whole black marketplace now where you can purchase these digital weapons that you shouldn't really be able to be obtainable or obtained yet by players. But what they do is they set up bots within these games, and bots just basically play it continuously for 24 hours a day. Now, if you have hundreds of thousands of players, and at peak there was about 2.8 million players on New World, how can you kind of police that and control that? And that's the dangers that we're falling into.
You mentioned the bane of my life at times, basically the famous bot, because the amount of hours that have been spent in apparently meaningless conversation just to actually get through to a human being with the bot screen in front of on is very frustrating. But that's perhaps another issue. The metaverse, as we look ahead to obviously the latest incarnation, obviously, of Mark Zuckerberg's empire and so on, suggests it's going to be a wonderful online utopia. It seems from what you've been saying, this could well turn out very quickly in terms of an online dystopia.
Yeah, so again, like the word metaverse, let's look at like a doctor, right? that's just a form of either a neurologist, a dermatologist, or so many variations of that particular word. Similar to metaverse, a lot of people are thinking, okay, this is this one game that's like, that's it, it's going to revolutionize, you know, the world in a sense, but it's not. It's a collective of all types of VR games or all types of VR environments. So yeah, Meta are leading the way in the way that they're kind of laying the landscape for other developers to do, but this concept's been around since the early noughties, such as Second Life. That was a prominent game back in 2000 and X. And essentially, a lot of people would go in there and they'd play in this virtual environment and virtual world, and they'd trade money like Linden. That was their currency at the time and still is the currency. But even stuff like corporations and employers would buy these types of development land in this virtual environment and take their employees on corporate retreats. So it's been around for a long period of time. They're just kind of revolutionizing it with the VR aspects. So the more immersion, the more kind of creativity, allowing users to take control of what they want to do inside these particular worlds.
Another one of my minor irritations, but at the same time is a minor irritation, are those wonderful three letters MFA. We need it for university accounts. We need it obviously for banking details, for financial transactions. It would seem, Jamie, that you would be an advocate certainly of setting up multi-factor authentication formats to prevent this scamming taking place, though.
Yeah, you're quite right, Alex. So MFA should be across anything, not just the gaming world. You know, it should be enabled on all your accounts. And for those who don't know, MFA is multi-factor authentication. So it's setting up like Google Authenticator, or if you have a Microsoft account, Microsoft Authenticator, allowing you kind of a one-time passcode that changes pretty much every 30 seconds that's unique to you when you were setting that up during the process. So it, let's say, for instance, if you use that password that you've used for everywhere and your account gets compromised, you'll get an alert or a notification through to your mobile device. And what you can do is you can then reset your passwords and have control back over your accounts. So always enable MFA on anything that you can. It massively helps to secure you. From a social media perspective, you know, check your privacy settings. You know, if your children game or play games on consoles, etc., look at the family safety settings. You can go onto the manufacturers and developers' websites of these consoles, and they have really good step-by-step guides that you can follow. You know, and then you can educate your children about some of the dangers as well found in these environments.
Is it going to be very long before MFA becomes literally yesterday's news and we have to look at biometrics and retina scans and so on to prove that we are who we say we are?
I mean, yeah, it won't be long before some kind of rift, you know, does scan your iris to get inside these virtual environments. But I think for now, MFA is a really good starting point. You know, it's a concept that's been around for ages, but still, you know, like my mother hasn't adapted it, my father hasn't adapted it, and, you know, they're very old school in their approach to doing things. But, you know, like my daughter, she's 3 years old, she's grown up with technology, right? She's, you know, I'm teaching her to do some developing at the moment. I can't wait till she can be a debugger. It will make my life a lot easier. But again, she's grown up with that, so she understands how you download apps from the app store and plays these games, etc., on a tablet all day long. So the next generation that comes to that, it'll be just the normality of it.
Well, again, people might have been listening to this and could have been terrified into a digital nightmare, but people want to find out further information and indeed access some of your tips, very sage ones they are, Jamie. How where should they proceed? Is there a website that you'd recommend?
Yeah, so it depends as well. So based on the consoles, let's say you play Xbox or PlayStation, you can go onto Sony's website or Microsoft Xbox website. A lot of guides and tutorials you can find on there. A lot of these platforms and consoles have an ambassador program, so you can reach out to a community ambassador and ask them questions as well. But it's really down to the console that you're using, or if you're gaming on a PC or definitely not on a Mac, but a laptop. And just ensuring that you have the up-to-date antivirus on your system. If you don't have one, go and purchase one from a reputable brand. TalkTalk offers some really good award-winning software, SuperSafe, so you can check that out via Google or different search engines to locate. And it's about keeping on top. I always kind of go back to hygiene, right? We brush our teeth, we have a shower, we wash our hands, we do this thing all the time, so, you know, without thinking of it in a sense. We need to adapt cyber hygiene in our lifestyle, right? So we need to hide our PIN numbers when using an ATM. Don't share our passcodes or passwords with any of our friends, etc. Just make sure we adapt it and it becomes second nature.
And Jamie, I have to ask you, why did you wish to hack into Kim Kardashian's account? Was it just something you felt needed to be done? Was it the challenge? What was the purpose?
Oh, Alex.
Or so is that a whole another interview?
No, it was just so part of a responsible disclosure scheme. There's a way that you can hack websites legitimately. So I used to make money growing up. I started hacking when I was 9 years old. I'm autistic, dyslexic, dyspraxic, so I've always resonated with technology. So part of my pocket money, my very first hack, I used to disable one of my neighbors' internets, a guy called Jeff, and every Friday he'd knock on the door and I'd charge him £20 to fix it. And that was my first entrepreneurial journey into cybersecurity. But it had always been a thing of mine to find these new weaknesses and new ways into infrastructure. And with Kim's website, I found out that over 50 million accounts could be compromised. I reached out to her and her team. I made them aware of it. I did a whole news campaign piece about it a few years ago. And yeah, that's how that came about.
Well, there you go. And that is why you are the UK's leading ethical hacker, but like the Simon Templar of the internet, you're too young to remember the saint, but what the hey. Jamie Woodruff, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and keep protecting us.
Thank you.